Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, a brief look at a range of arts projects in and around Cambridge and a chance to hear directly from the artists, poets and writers who make it all happen. In this edition, we take a glimpse at Open Studios in its second weekend and talk to artists at two key venues open today. Cambridge writer and playwright Rani Drew reviews a new book and talks about life experiences on several continents and a passion for combating injustice, and her husband poet John Drew recites. A children's book illustration course opens at Cambridge School of Art. The rubbish you find dumped in your bike basket inspires a new citywide art project. And we explore augmented reality and a cinematic sound walk through Cambridge's streets, making moving symphonies in public places. But first, let's take a look at what's coming up in the city in the next few days. Willie Russell's Blood Brothers opens at the Arts Theatre on Monday. A pair of twins separated at birth grow up on opposite sides of the tracks and meet up again with tragic consequences, starring Maureen Nolan as Mrs. Johnson. Kettlejard Gallery presents Associate Artists opening today, presenting work by Mattai Benjanaru, Matthew Derbyshire, Lorna McClintyre, Jeremy Miller, and displays work reacting to selected items which have a story or theme from the Kettlejard Collection and Archives. Adjacent St Peter's Church also has work displayed. Cambridge Shakespeare Festival in its centenary year is now underway with performances in five college gardens until the end of August. This year's lineup: Julius Caesar, The Tempest, The Merry Wives of Windsor, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Twelfth Night, King Lear and As You Like It. It's expected to attract some 25,000 people, but do take a good umbrella. The Botanical Garden celebrates the Summer Music Festival with three-dimensional jazz on Wednesday next week, followed by flamenco fusion quartet Troubadour on the following Wednesday, July the 18th. Picnics are invited. Coming up, The Junction hosts a stage version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which reunites the original radio and TV cast directed by Dirk Maggs. Cambridge Comedy Festival kicks off on July the 17th and features 40 shows, including celebrity performers Phil Jupiter, Stephen K. Amos and Richard Herrin. You found us. This is Cambridge 105. The yellow street flags of Open Studios beckon in its second weekend this month as 253 artists at 180 venues across the city invite people to come in and meet them and talk about their latest work in their studios. The work spans painting, photography, sculpture, ceramics, textiles and jewellery, and a few innovative surprises, as I discovered when I dropped in for a sneak preview to Covent Garden Drama Studio. Artist Diane Scarborough is a digital art teacher and engineer, and she was setting up exhibits with painter, printmaker and teacher Andrew Litchfield. Diana, first of all, you've got some very interesting things in your hand there. What are they?
Oh, well, they're actually etchings. And etchings, these are making drawings using metal and printing. And they're radio dials. I'm very interested in old technology, specifically analog technology. And I'm looking at the beauty of these dials here. For me, I believe that technology can be beautiful. And it is about radio, particularly, and it was a British heyday of kind of radio design, especially Cambridge and Pi and things. So as an artist, I'm interested in technology. I'm interested in the text of these old radio dials. And I'm also, I guess, slightly political, that in 2015, these well-loved radios that people like will be silenced forever. So my art is about looking at the beauty without nostalgia and sort of zooming in, honing in. What I'm showing at Covent Garden, I'm showing the space with two other artists. They are looking at print, they look at paintings. So I am bringing, it's a group exhibition. Yeah. So rather than all my recent work, I'm for myself, I'm bringing prints and etchings of radio dials. I'm also bringing paintings, which are more of a, well, you'll have a look, Henry Moore style.
Do you both work a lot in isolation? And is this an opportunity where you actually let people in and talk about it?
I think all of us, the three of us, are teachers teaching in different areas. Yeah. So in some way we talk about art. We do share experience of visiting art galleries, but generally I think we work in isolation. and then we get together and have a discussion about that. I think what's also, as an artist, sometimes you value opinions of others, and there's, you know, I value the opinion of, say, you know, Andrew and Sheena. So it is about having real feedback, and that helps. Would you agree?
And making ends meet, do you ever have to sell work that you really wouldn't want to part with in order to survive sometimes?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I live in my work, and, you know, I will miss it greatly when it goes, but I think it's good to start a new leaf, to sell work, and to just keep that sort of cycle going, really, making and selling.
Open Studios is a key artistic event for creative people with learning disabilities at arts-based charity Rowan Humberston. Today is a major focal point of the year, when all the work by 59 students, 10 volunteers and teachers is displayed at Studios at 40 Humberstone Road. Artist Abigail Moore is assistant manager and runs the ceramics workshop.
At Rowan, we are a charity working with adults with learning disabilities. We're a based charity where we work with wood, clay, various painting, sculptures, all sort of mixed media. And the students come here, and between us and all the volunteers and members of staff, we collaborate and make pieces of artwork.
How important is it to be creative if you are disabled or have learning difficulties?
I think being creative, it's something that encompasses everybody, likes to have use their hands to be able to express themselves in different ways. And particularly if, say, for example, you find it difficult with communication or speech, it can be a nice way to sort of put some of your ideas or things out there onto paper, or using a different medium to create things.
Yeah, and on the mediums, what is the range of artwork that is produced by your workshop?
We make small ceramic birds, animals, planters and things. We make large wooden mirror pieces, different prints and paintings, various animated films and sort of the set to go along with that. Quite a lot of different things.
Now, is Open Studio something that you look forward to all the way through the year as an opportunity to bring that artwork and meet the public with it?
It's brilliant, actually. We've been doing Open Studios for many years now, and it's been one of our best ways for people to come into Rowan, to see the work here, to see the workshops. And we have as many people working through looking at the gallery and the workshops and getting a real view of what our guys get up to here. So yes, we always look forward to it in the gallery.
Okay, we've got some fabulous looking, what I would describe as ceramic sculptures.
Yes,
are they?
Yes, yeah. Well, they're inspired by looking at the work of Henry Moore, and each of the students or groups of students looked at a particular sculpture they liked the look of, and then they had a go themselves at recreating it from clay. So it's a real nice mix, and then we used a bronze glaze to cover them with to give that sort of Henry Moore-esque finish to them as well.
Those are really imaginative and wonderful. This one looks that's someone at a skew-width angle, as it were, resting.
Yes. Yeah, it's a recumbent figure.
In a strange pose. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
And is there a concept behind this one with the strings?
Again, actually, I think that one was a Henry Moore as well, and again was looking at the student who was, and her mum was helping her with that. We sometimes have different carers or mums coming in to help out at times, and they worked together looking at the colours and the type of wire they wanted to put on it together to just finish it off.
Women who have a strong sense of their own feelings and identity in the world that doesn't match the roles imposed upon them can find themselves in an endangered minority for daring to stick up for their true selves publicly. That's especially true in the real world if you come from India and are expected to be a traditional Asian wife living in the West. Cambridge author, lecturer and playwright Rani Drew has swum against the tide of other people's expectations and also travelled widely, and she draws upon experiences in Singapore, Punjab, China, Hungary, Denmark, Canada, Romania and Macedonia in her feminist writings. Her 30-plus plays for both radio and stage highlight situations in which women can find themselves and which often transcend history, reaching back through the ages. She uses Shakespeare's women as reference points for her scenarios and does amazing things with her knowledge of classic legends, folklore, history and religion, creating imaginative work highlighting injustices and how women cope with them. Here she introduces her latest novel, The Dog's Tale, and talks about her life. Rani, you seem to me to be a fantastically widely travelled person that must have a huge amount of experience to draw upon as a writer. Can you tell me a little bit about some of your experiences in foreign countries and in Hungary in particular?
Okay, well, we've lived in Singapore, and the thing about me is that I always enjoy wherever I am and probably remain unaware of the political aspect of the place. And I remember when we were going to Singapore, somebody in the marketplace I knew, she said to me, "Oh, so you're going to Singapore. Are you aware of why, you know, what sort of country Singapore is?" So I said, "No." And anyway, when we got there, I was conscious of what the lady had said. But, you know, we have our own way of living, and that was fine. So we were there for 2 years. We came back, and then we had an opportunity to go to China, to Shanghai for 2 years. John, my husband, got a job with the British Council, and that was fantastic. I really loved it. I had already started writing, and so China, Shanghai, was the first country I performed my third play, which was about English women. Women are talking, and funnily enough, when they saw they acted in the play, and then when they saw it, the students said, "Oh, but that's the same in China." Well, I thought that's a good comment on English life. And then we came back. We were there, and during the Tiananmen 1989, although we stayed there after the Tiananmen event, we came back after that. We went back again and stayed there for another year. And when we came back, John was given a job in Hungary. So there we stayed for 9 years.
What interests you the most about using theatre as a medium?
Well, when I redid my BA degree, my Indian degree here, and I really didn't know anything about feminism. I was such a good wife and such a good woman. And I asked my teacher, "What's the difference between feminism and femininity?" And lo and behold, I discovered the difference. And I tested it out, how much women have contributed to history and how much men have. And so I said to myself, I'm going to write about women only, and I will make them heard and seen. Now, the stage was the best thing. And ever since then, I've written about 40 plays, and they're all about women. The latest is about four Iraqi women who rise up to their own men, and the Americans.
You've written, obviously, a series of plays for both radio and stage. You include The Tempest, and you created a sequel to it called Caliban. Why did you do that?
Well, again, I've written three plays about Shakespeare, and I call them Shakespeare Reformed. And none of them are Shakespeare's own plays, but I've challenged him by rewriting him. Hamlet, I did, which was the three-act Hamlet. Then I wrote one, Shakespeare and Me, which is about women, all the female characters in 10 of them in Shakespeare. So you want me to say more about Tempest?
Well, what I was going to say basically is that, you know, I noticed that you're doing this kind of thing. For someone like you who comes initially from India,
yes.
Do you think that Shakespeare's women are relevant in today's world, and that Elizabethan England translates into the world that you experience and still has those chords that run through it, in terms of his observations about women like Portia, Hermione, you know, yes. All these fiery characters?
Yes. Shakespeare and Me, there are two characters, and in that I've taken the female characters, 10 of them from Shakespeare, and I have put them in the modern framework. And in that there is a feminine type of woman. So, for example, to give a good example, I did the first scene of Othello, and when Desdemona wakes up and she sees Othello sort of, you know, bending over her and gritting his teeth, she says, "Stop it, my lord. I've had enough of you. I'm going to leave you now. All this business of, you know, moody and threatening me with this and that." She calls her maid and she says, "Get my carriage and I'm leaving him." Now, the feminine woman breaks down and cries because her boyfriend, a skinhead — in those days, Hungary was full of skinheads — she says, "You know, he does the same to me." So in some way, I've done it in the opposite way. Rather than make the woman put up with an abusive husband, I've made her her march out on him, and also has an influence. She has an influence on the woman who is still continuing to do that. So I think you can probably find Shakespearean women now, but also the opposite.
So you're trying to capture situations like that that were seen in a different way during the Elizabethan time. If they occurred in the modern world, we've moved on from that, but the passions are the same.
Yes. And I think you can probably find the same, the very, powerful women, and the women who decide to be powerless, despite all the improvement and the advancement that so many centuries have brought about.
And which category do you put yourself in?
I have my favorite sentence. I say, I was a good woman then. I followed my husband like a good woman from India. But then when the awakening came, I thought, well, I need to stand up and be counted for better or worse. And that's why all my work, all my 40 plays, a lot of them are very, very feminist, and some of them, like Darwin's plays recently, I did bring in Emma Darwin also. So there is always an input of women.
Great. Okay, can you tell me a little bit about Cleopatra? What's that play about?
Okay, now, Cleopatra, why I wrote it, I don't know. But an idea comes, and then I go into it, and I do research, and then I think, oh, yes. I think the reason I think behind writing about Cleopatra was that she was a powerful woman, and she stood up again to the Romans. Yes, she stood up to the Romans, and she had a bad name. She has been treated like a slut. And, this is what women have had in the past, and sometimes even now, that if they stand up, then they are not good women. And also, there is still a Greek community left over from when Alexander went to India. I suppose this is sort of romantic bit. And I thought, there is some relevance to that. And her name, Cleopatra, I put it in that Kaliputri, and that's a very old sort of Hindu, pre-Islamic Hindu literature name, because she wanted to send her son away before the Romans could take him away to India. Now, I'm not sure if that's true or whether I've made it up, and I can't see the difference between
you,
the
you seem to draw on the ancients to some degree. You've got stories about Romans, Christians, Greeks. You've got the flavour of Cleopatra in it. In the book that we've come to talk about today, you have passages from a play which is about the Magyar, who are a sort of rebellious tribe, and they're planning to band together and take on the Romans. So those kind of exchanges are important to your writing. Those are things you draw upon.
So I thought, well, that would be an interesting way of introducing history rather than the grandma telling more and more stories. I went into the theatre. So that was really good, because with the theatre, you can bring out history. Well, Shakespeare does it all the time.
And it gives you opportunities to collaborate with other people in terms of expressing those stories and those ideas vividly. Now, obviously, in your writing, you go through lots of themes: injustice, racism, spiritual beliefs, witch hunts, miners' wives, human trafficking and prostitution, bombings in Kenya, and persecution. All of these things are things that are driving you to write and tackle all of those issues.
I mean, it's just that if I, for example, bombing in Kenya, I read that and I thought, that's just like Antigone, trying to bury people and demanding the corpse, because that is the last right human beings pride themselves on, in difference with the animals who leave their dead out and about. So anything that strikes me, it's almost like an idea just sort of, hits me, and I say, This is what I should write on, and then I do.
Which authors have influenced you the most? I mean, I look at some of your bios and the things that you've written, and I can see, obviously, Kafka. This is a Kafka-esque novel, Shakespeare, Tolstoy, and Freud. But which ones do you really draw upon?
I think Kafka was very influential, because I did him in my European thought and literature and thought. And I'm really, really, really pleased that I took that course, because I was already into the Greeks, but it took me more into the Greeks. And the Greeks come back into my writing the whole time. And Kafka and Freud, because my three-act Hamlet, I used Freud in the son and father relationship. And if my Hamlet had gone to his father like the Shakespeare one did, then there would have been no story. But he became a feminist, he became a Renaissance man, whereas in Shakespeare he loses out on that.
Okay, obviously you've got some really good original ideas here. I've been having a read of The Dog's Tale, which is the title of this novel. What, I mean, you're making the imaginative use of the eternal puzzle that people notice in their domestic dogs. What's going on behind the eyes of the animal? Because the eyes are full of something, and you don't know what's there. Is it intelligent, and what is it thinking? Well, you've taken that a step further, haven't you? Please explain.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, yesterday at the painting exhibitions, the July exhibitions, somebody said to me, you know, they are now discovering that humans and dogs, they perceive the world in similar way. Now, that's what I'm saying in my book, that whether it is similar or dissimilar, the human beings, when they start to domesticate animals, they are not bothered. They want to humanize them, but in a limited way, the way they did with the slaves. You know, the slaves had to remain slaves. And I think that the animals are more sensitive, and they do listen, and they do respond, and they probably respond more than we think that they do. And they see that when things happen to their master or mistresses, then they can sensitize,
empathize with them. Now, in this novel, you yourself are the dog. You're not a human being at all. You're seeing the world from the perspective of a dog, and you adopt its personality as you see it. Presumably, you've observed your dog very closely, and you've adopted its personality, and then put on the mask of the dog's existence. What's the essence of all of this? What are you trying to drive at?
What I'm trying to drive at is that although without humans, for humans, there would be no world, there would be no society, there would be no perception, we are probably are about to give way to greater evolution. And it won't be a surprise if the animals will take over, or the machines will take over. I've just written a play, The Descent of Bot, which is about robots. And the robots are going to be on the next evolutionary rung. And I'm writing a sequel to this, in which the dog leaves Hungary and goes through all sorts of... He pals up with a wolf who in this book also figures. And they end up in the Arctic region, and they find that there are still dogs being enslaved by human beings. So they lead a revolution and call upon these dogs to stand up to men. They push the men out, and they want to take over that part of the world. At another point, I thought the animals should actually push humans out completely, but I've changed my mind to that now.
Do you think that animal intelligence is like a sort of witness to human intelligence, in so much as that they have that sort of pure form of God-given intelligence, and you're using it as a way of holding a mirror from an obscure angle on what happens in the action involving the people?
I think that's very, very good. I think your observation is very good. And I think it must be so. From being within the book myself, it is difficult for me to put all that into words. But it must have been there because that's what I'm doing. And I'm just hoping that there should be, you know, animals. I mean, what's happening to animals is terrible. They are tagged. They are followed. They are, I mean, it just is...
This is, in many ways, talking about an instinctive and peaceful path in a wicked world where there are all these things which you find it difficult to deal with. Do you yourself feel as though you are a misunderstood creature at heart and a mistreated person? Because the story starts off with this dog being abandoned and deserted, and then the salvation of a rescue, and that's where it all begins. Do you have feelings of that sort, or are you drawing on experiences of that sort?
No, not within myself. I would, you know, my Indian name is Ranjit Kaur. Yeah. Ranjit means the winner of battles. Yeah. And I am a winner of battles. I've got no time to sit down and cry about what I've had. I've always sort of, you know, marched on from, you know, with taking the booty in my hand, which is relating to me. I'm not aggressive. I don't want to, you know, change other people. I think there's room for everyone. So I'm not, it's not, you know, making use of my relating to my own self, although there must be some of it there, definitely, but relating to lots of other people and including myself also.
You're sharing where things you feel need to be fought in the world.
Yes, and I think you're going back to, you know, I've drawn off my own things, my own experience. I think there could be something of that there also, but also looking generally at, for example, you know, a women's thing. I'm always sort of saying, look, you go somewhere and it's always women who are serving. They used to be secretaries before. Now they are sort of part of reception. Would you believe it that there is now an MA course which is called reception, how to teach women to be a reception? So, and I'm sure that I've actually used some of my own experiences.
Now you're giving the dog a special status, which is an intelligent status, but this is also implicitly saying that this is about the way women are treated as well.
Yes. And I think if you just pick up the newspaper and read, it is quite amazing how there are pieces about women and you say, oh no, that can't be true, but it is.
In the novel there's lots of natural experiences. It's a very tactile piece of writing. It gives the dog a personality. It's warm and friendly, and you can feel this sort of wagging tail at the back of it, which is pointing to all kinds of things that you're supposed to notice as a reader. Do you really relish intense natural experiences? You describe hot springs, lots of tactile things to do with nature.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, I do, because I'm also a painter. But oh, sorry, I shouldn't say I'm a painter, but I paint. Yeah, that's the distinction I make. And to me, it is a delight to look out at nature and at the trees. I mean, the trees, I always wonder, I always say the trees have always stood in one place and how much they give us, and they've never moved. And I always wonder whether one tree looks at another tree at a distance and say, oh, I wish I could get together with that tree, and they can't, you know. So I do feel that there is a lot there, you know, the eyes see a lot, the ears also hear a lot, but the eyes, the perception, our perception, eyes are the, you know, in ways of our perception. And I try and reproduce the natural scene because it is just so delightful, and it is so much, it gives us so much. Like all beings desire, you know, the desire is the word. We desire things. We desire that we should have a better life. We should have more freedom. We should be able to talk more. We shouldn't suffer from fear. And he loves his mistress, but he feels that there is not enough of him. You know, when you think that our pets never know other animals because they go with us where we go, and they never know the natural world. And so there is a desire, there must be a desire in animals, if they see it, if they see an opening, to head for the wilds.
It's fantastic. Rennie Drew, lots of fascinating stuff that people still haven't seen, but this book, well worth picking up, The Dog's Tale by Rennie Drew. All I can say to anybody is read it. It's great fun, and it's available at your local bookstore. I don't suppose
yes,
I should.
Yes, Waterstones, definitely. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Great stuff. Rennie, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Rennie Drew is only one half of a talented duo. Her husband, John Drew, is a former journalist and Cambridge University poetry lecturer, and he's travelled widely with Rennie during work in countries with the British Council and as an overseas correspondent. John draws on his journalism, which makes his poetry accessible, and likes writing in a bardic role for particular occasions. Here's two brief recitals. The first is for his wife Rennie, and the following of a moment captured outside Cambridge University Library in, well, yes, in the pouring rain.
So many others, because unknown, are subject to poetry. All their talents idealised. With them I can make free. With you it has to be otherwise, between you and me. You want real freedom, not framed by my mind's eye. Here or there in your own right, bound by no tie, except for one which could survive, I not being I. To be acknowledged for what you are, not what may appear. To be consumed by passion and love, not constraint and fear. This lived, not written about. What a romantic idea. Why should poetry take the smooth and life be left with the rough? Perhaps you demand too much, or could it be not enough? I blame you and you blame me. We each go off in a huff. Writing poems and living life are both affairs of the heart. Matter needs all its magic, and not just at the start. 30 years we've been thrown together, and 30 torn apart. Lives, like poems, disintegrate, in spite or because of our art. I in the skirts of a cedar tree to shelter from the rain. My clothes wet through. Summer. Then came she, likewise. Evidently, she supposed, I was some kind of professor, able to answer her questions. How was I to address her, who could offer few suggestions? She was so very young. How nice. You'd have had to be very dull to adopt an air of knowing, give advice, or note that the rain had stopped.
Children's book illustration is an art form more rewarding than most, and is a passionate life vocation for those who do it. Anglia Ruskin University is about to run a children's book illustration summer school in early August, which has a high-powered set of tutors and features talks by some celebrated illustrators. Cambridge School of Arts illustration lecturer Pam Smy is inviting applications and introduces the course.
The tutors on the course are Paula Metcalf and myself. We're both lecturers on the MA Children's Book Illustration, and we'll be working in the studio throughout the week. And then alongside us, we've got a specialist illustrators coming in. Axel Scheffler, illustrator of The Gruffalo, Alexis Deacon, Paula Metcalf, Marta Altes, and Martin Salisbury as well. And what we're looking for is to give people an insight throughout the week, take them through the process, which in real life with a publisher would possibly take a year. We're cramming it into a week. Mm-hmm. But what I've aimed to do with the course is to make sure that when we're getting specialists coming in, if we're dealing with text and image, we're getting an illustrator who's especially keyed into their specialism or characterization. We're getting somebody who's really understands how to get a character to sing in a picture book, so which is why we've chosen such a range of illustrators for the week.
Now, children's imaginations require extraordinary things from illustrators, don't they, to bring their world alive in a really imaginative way. Is that talent difficult to develop, do you think?
In children or in illustrators?
In illustrators, yeah.
Yes, sometimes I think the best illustrators are those who aren't childish, but remember how it feels to be a child and can relate to children. There's a childlikeness about them. Mm. Not necessarily their work. Their artwork can be very sophisticated, but they're not talking down to children. They're just being able to tap into something quite essential. I do think that for children there's an ability to associate with a character very strongly or a situation, one or the other. So you could be following an adventure with a very strong character that you empathise with, or you find very funny, or you want to be in that adventure. And sometimes it can be, you can have abstract picture books where they're just about shapes, but it's about the story somehow that carries you along. There's that whole element of illustrating very traditional themes like fairies and ogres and things that have been around for centuries. And then there's also, children are very interested in things that reflect their own experience, that having a big sister who won't lend you their toys, or being worried about your first day at nursery, or missing your dad when he goes away. And so children live in the real world, so there's the whole strand of picture books about that. And they encompass this wonderful fantasy imaginative world that we all enjoyed so much as children.
Now, I saw some fantastic illustrations here during the degree show by some of your students. It was extremely promising. Has there been anything really new and exciting just recently in the sector of children's illustrations that you'd like to put
Well, on? There's some books that are just coming out this autumn that I think everybody should be looking out for. Mm. They're from some of our MA graduates who graduated last year. Birgitta Siff is having her book Oliver published by Walker Books coming out this autumn, and Marta Altes, who is going to be lecturing on our course, her book Grandpa, My Grandpa, has just come out, and they both deal with relationships of friendships. One is with a grandpa, and Oliver is about a child who's a bit lonely, but they're absolutely exquisite, very new, raw, exciting talent that's out there. Most of our students, especially on the MA, are astonishingly passionate, and the summer school quite often is feeding it. People come along and give it a bit of a taster, come into the summer school, see how they feel about it, the environment, the things we're teaching, the things that we're dealing with, and in that sense they're then able to see if the study on the master's course is for them.
It sounds like a very important summer school here at Anglia Ruskin University. Children's illustrators, people should get in touch.
Yes, thank you. That would be great.
It's a common enough experience in Cambridge to unlock your bicycle and then discover something odd has been posited in the basket by a passerby. A group of artists want to hear from you and trace possible stories that might be attached in terms of what we can tell about a person by using some simple forensics on what they left behind. Dumped runs till October and analyses, examines and interprets unusual items of what it calls garbology, and then assembles messages to respond to the findings, which are also photographed and catalogued. The scheme, curated by Robert Good, hopes to go citywide over the next couple of months to see what turns up and then to present a show with actors and the findings. Site-responsive artist John O'Hare, a former student at Liverpool John Moores University, is interested in dereliction and overlooked things and has a local studio with St Barnabas Press.
I'm interested in the almost shamanistic power that art has to transform what we sometimes overlook. Items that have been overlooked or considered obsolete and useless. Not always rubbish, but this is a nice departure.
Okay, now the project, I'm told, culminates with an actor's public reading of the responses that are derived from looking at these objects. What will that involve exactly?
It will basically involve character given to these strangers that have had some sort of contact with the owners of the bicycle baskets. I'm hoping it will range. I'm really hoping for a diverse responses, whereby some are poetic, some are scientific, and some are quite mundane.
Okay, now you're also going to be working with a photographer called Masek Palikowski.
That's right.
What are his particular talents as a photographer?
He's a local photographer, and he's been working in Cambridge for some 6 years. He is effectively working as a kind of reporter for this project, collecting the visuals across Cambridge.
Great. Okay, this is going to culminate in an exhibition in October in Cambridge in 2012, where you're going to look at ideas of art, text, and place. And this is being curated by an artist called Robert Good. Why is he the curator for it? Does he have a special talent for this kind of thing? Or
the artist Robert Good, I've recently been in touch with him. It's quite early days on the project. He's interested in text. He's doing a citywide project in Cambridge whereby artists interested in text are going to explore new avenues publicly.
So it sounds like great fun. What should people do when they find something in their basket that they think is worth reporting? Do you have a website or somewhere where they can do a little blog on whatever it was or the circumstances which happened, which can be the starting point, presumably, for the work on in the art dimension on it?
That would be fantastic. I'm asking people to get in touch with me. I'm asking to get in touch via freespaceprojects@gmail.com or through take a look at my website where there's some more information, which is johnohare.org.uk.
A new sound for a new generation. This is Cambridge 105.
Looking back, it's been an eventful month in June as the city streets filled up with dressed-up Mabel revellers and the night sky was lit by plenty of interesting fireworks. But other things have been happening too. The Visualised Public Art Programme series took to the city streets, experimenting with music in public spaces in the early evenings. An event called Of Sleeping Birds invited people in groups of 40 to join a musical cinematic walk through the city streets, carrying music-emitting boxes in a carefully planned moving mobile symphony. Artist Duncan Speakman and Sarah Anderson introduced the walk.
So these are our little portable speaker boxes. They're little kind of hand-designed, handheld speakers. Yeah, so each one has a speaker on the front, and inside is a satellite-controlled sound system. So it uses location position, like car navigation, to play different sounds at different locations. We've kind of started calling it a pedestrian symphony. So the idea is that the audience will carry these boxes, and each box is playing a different part of the music that we've written. So one box might be the violin part, one might be a voice, one might be a texture or an effect, and then as the sort of audience carry them, they sort of become this walking orchestra moving through the streets.
It's quite in keeping with our usual style, I guess, of quite sort of traditional orchestral instrumentation mixed with electronics and lots of processing and real-time processing and the found sounds that we record around the city that we're working in. So this time it's been Cambridge, and those might be quite subliminal things that you hear, but they're all there, and hopefully, yeah, work with the architecture.
Are there some amazing things you can do with acoustics with so many speakers?
Absolutely. I mean, the idea with this piece is that the audience participants actually mix the arrangement. So, you know, you may have one part of an orchestra that you're holding along the walk, and then it's up to you really to start working with the environment and the acoustics that you're walking through. So
you can bounce the sound off the walls around you, and we try and have almost conversations between the speakers. So sometimes we pass sounds from one speaker to another, so it's like the sound is travelling through the group of people.
If you'd witnessed the event, you'd have been forgiven for thinking Cambridge's streets are sometimes on another planet, with groups of people in evening dress and bands of artists drifting around making strange and unexplained noises. We crossed the market square in four groups of 10 box holders as the GPS alternated the emissions and then played with the new acoustics in the Grand Arcade. A bunch of raving loonies, some people thought, but others were quite intrigued at the unpredictable nature of the piece. As we crossed the parks on Christ Pieces, noises like angry gnats began buzzing.
Oh,
It's called Augmented Reality, I'm told, where you look at your life and the life you share differently in public spaces by making it cinematic with mobile technology and then reflecting upon it. On the walk was Emily Kanye, who wrote Honeycomb Stitches, the next in the series, using a smartphone app you download with a poetic micro-walk.
Tell me about Honeycomb Stitches. What is that? That's an event using a smartphone, is it?
Some sort? Yes, yeah. It is a series of 6 micro-sound walks that are happening in Cambridge that you download onto your iPhone, and you basically put your headphones on and go for a micro-walk and hopefully see your everyday streets in a different way.
And what kind of things do you point out during this walk? I mean, can you give me a few of the surprises that come through on it?
It's... our work is very much about the daily life that surrounds you, so about your daily routines and the things that you forget to notice because you pass by them or you experience them every day.
Yeah.
And it's about pointing them out with a musical score that makes you see your daily life in a filmic way.
There's a story, obviously, in practically every street in Cambridge of one thing or another. What kind of stories do you talk about when you talk about, you know?
Well, for us, for me at least, it was very interesting being from Canada and not knowing much of Cambridge, but learning about Cambridge through its inhabitants. Yeah. And one of the things that we did in researching Honeycomb Stitches was to ask people to record voice messages on a specific day. And we were inspired by those very specific messages that told us what was happening in Cambridge on that day, how was the sun, how the weather was, what they saw, what they felt, and we incorporated those into narratives and stories to be true. In that sense, they're like documentaries, and these people's voices can also be heard in these micro sound walks. So,
what are you hoping people will go away with at the end of an experience like that?
I'm hoping there's this thing called augmented reality now, and people artists are trying to step into or tap into this resource of an added layer of information on your everyday life.
Yeah.
But I think just people shouldn't forget that they're not alone in their daily routines and that others are like them and others share stories. And it is about trying to reach out and into other people.
Yeah.
If all this wet weather has kept you at home and at a loose end for something interesting to do, then an outing to Wising Arts Open Weekend is worth a visit. This afternoon, artists present spoken word performances and film screenings, and there'll be a discussion session on the metaphor of the mirror with resident artists Ed Atkins, Nicholas Deshayes, Philomene Parecki and Elizabeth Price. It's chaired by Kettles Yard's Jeremy Miller. Artist studios will be opened across the site and families are welcome. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton and I hope you enjoyed the hour.